The Knowledgeable Provider podcast is intended primarily to entertain, also to inform, but it is not a substitute for actual medical training and should not be used by anyone to diagnose or treat any medical condition in themselves or others. If you need medical advice, please make an appointment to see your own knowledgeable medical provider. The opinions expressed by me and anyone else who happens to appear on the podcast are solely those of the people expressing them and are not necessarily representative of any other entities. Other than the lunches at the office, I do not receive any sort of compensation from pharmaceutical or medical device companies, and I have no other relevant financial disclosures. Look, this is all for fun, okay? Don't sue me. All right, on with the show. Hello, welcome back to Knowledgeable Provider. I'm your host, Jody Marks. On this episode, I thought I'd do a little recap of some things I learned at a conference I went to recently. This is the Huntsville Hospital Cardiology Update 2024. It was held on February 10th over at the beautiful College of Nursing at UA Huntsville. I looked at the flyer for this and I started not to go. You know, sometimes in primary care, it seems like the specialty conferences may not have a lot to offer as far as things that would be pertinent to our daily practice. But it was on a Saturday morning when I could go without taking off work. And it was like $40 for a four-hour thing that came with CEU credit. So I decided to give it a shot, and I'm glad I did. I learned more that would be applicable to my practice than I expected. And it was really well done. I thought it was well put together. So I encourage you to look for these conferences and similar things to attend in the future. The CEUs add up, and it's a good way to not only learn things that would be useful in practice, but also to meet some of the people who are practicing in your area, and even do some networking if you're so inclined. I ran into my friend April Klar, who was previously a guest on the program, and that was worth going all by itself. I put a few pictures up on the Knowledgeable Provider Facebook page if you want to check it out. So yeah, I'm just going to go through the notes that I took for each talk and pass along the things that I learned, and maybe some of it will be useful for you. There are a ton of links in the show notes to different references and resources that are pertinent to the things I'm talking about. So yeah, let's get into it. The first session was by Dr. Jacqueline Green. She's an interventional cardiologist at Huntsville Hospital, and she talked about cardiopulmonary exercise testing. Dr. Green has a special interest in exercise and the benefits that that offers, and you could tell she was really passionate about the topic. She was, by her own admission, nerding out on the different studies and things that she showed, and she talked about the benefits of cardiopulmonary exercise testing, or CPET. This is like if you see pictures of professional cyclists or Olympic athletes, you'll see them in a lab, usually on a stationary bike, with this big mask strapped over their face with a hose that goes to it, hooked up to a bunch of machines. That is cardiopulmonary exercise testing. And this is actually a pretty strong predictor of mortality, specifically the measure called VO2, which is a measure of just how much oxygen the body is consuming in general. The better shape you're in, the more oxygen your body burns, and the higher the score. And she was saying that this is a very underutilized tool. It's actually not even available in Huntsville for patients. She was saying that even at the heart center, they have to send people to Birmingham or Nashville to get this testing done. She said that health insurance does cover this for some indications. She actually paid cash to have it done. I think she paid $100 for herself just to go have the testing. The kinesiology exercise program at UAH does have a lab for this, and apparently healthy folks can elect to go there and be tested, but they don't do it for patients. So it's not a place we can refer patients to. But if you or a family member would like to go be tested, I believe you can contact them and do that. So I'll put that contact information in the show notes. A couple other things she touched on in her talk that I didn't know or had forgotten. She mentioned that lactate is actually a really good fuel for slow twitch muscle fibers. And of course, when we think of lactate, we think of the waste product that builds up after exercise and makes us sore, right? Or a measure that we look at to figure out if someone's septic or not. I don't really think of that as being a good thing in any sense, but it was good to be reminded that the slow twitch muscle fibers actually do use lactate relatively efficiently as a fuel. And more of that lactate is actually produced by the fast twitch fiber. So there's a little synergy going on there within our muscles. She talked about research into the effects of COVID on the mitochondria and the whole theory that mitochondrial dysfunction is to blame for a lot of the long COVID symptoms. That's been in the news. I have read about that in a few different places, but she seemed pretty convinced that that's going to be a thing that pans out that maybe we'll be able to utilize for helping to treat those patients at some point in the future. I found an article on this from December of 2022 that I will link in the show notes. I will confess that I'd never have paid a whole lot of attention to lectures or information sources about exercise. To be very honest, I'm still the fat kid who was traumatized by the presidential physical fitness test in, you know, middle school. And even the word exercise just historically has been very off-putting to me. So I'm trying to be a little more open to that information and trying to use it more in practice as well as my own life. I do notice that I feel a whole lot better when I exercise regularly, and I try to share that with my patients and get them to do that as well. I'm definitely not somebody who is prescribing different METs of exercise for people to do. I pretty much just say, you know, something's better than nothing, and the more you can move, the better. Of course, there are time-based recommendations and intensity-based recommendations for exercise that you can give out if you are interested in that. So yeah, exercise, good. One thing that Dr. Green really focused on was a study that included data that show that people who are sedentary actually produce more lactate at rest. And so she showed us this graph of very sedentary people versus very athletic people. And there's a pretty significant difference in the level of lactate in their blood just at baseline when they're not doing anything. And the slope of the curve as physical activity increases was quite different for both groups. And so she said that was an aha moment for her because she related that to, I guess she is a pretty serious cyclist. And so she said until she looked at that, she had never really had a lot of empathy for people who were sedentary as far as, you know, encouraging them to exercise and that sort of thing. But when she saw it put in those terms, she was thinking about, well, I know how I feel when I'm close to maximum effort on the bike and how exhausting and uncomfortable that is. And she said, if that's how people feel just when they get up to walk across the room, I have a lot more sympathy or empathy for that. And she said that was a very eye-opening thing for her as far as how she talks to and counsels patients about exercise, which was nice to hear. You know, you look at a heart doctor who's obviously very athletic and in great shape, and somebody like me does not expect a ton of empathy from someone like that when they're telling you how you should not be fat and should exercise more. So I appreciated that a lot. The next session was by Dr. Juan Gallegos, who is a cardiothoracic surgeon at Huntsville Hospital, and he talked about repairing thoracic aortic aneurysms. This was probably the talk that was the most over my head and probably the least applicable to what I do every day. Of course, we do have patients that have aneurysms, and of course, usually these are just things that are found incidentally when they're having imaging for something else, and they end up just watching it. He did talk a little bit about how frequently he sends people for repeat imaging for surveillance. It sounds like typically he just does once a year, as long as they are stable and he's not super worried about it enlarging or rupturing. He did mention that there's been a change in the size threshold for when they consider repairing the aneurysms. Before, it's been 5.5 centimeters, and now that's come down to 5 centimeters, so a little bit more aggressive strategy for repairing thoracic aortic aneurysms. Lately, when I've been going to classes and lectures and things, I've been trying to be a little bit less chicken. By nature, I'm the person who wants to sit in the back and is scared to ask or answer a question. So now when I come into a class, I just march right on down to the front row, sit as close to the speaker as I possibly can. And as I'm listening to the talks, I try to come up with a question that I could ask that might not sound stupid. So I asked the first speaker, Dr. Green, about insurance coverage for the exercise testing. And I asked Dr. Gallegos about any clinical signs that a dum-dum like me should be paying attention to maybe pick up on these aneurysms early, other than just stumbling upon them as an incidental finding, or waiting until they rupture or dissect, which I hope patients are not coming to me when their aorta is rupturing. That would be a bad decision. But I was curious if there were any clinical signs that he was familiar with or had seen that maybe we should be looking for. If you read the literature about this, it pretty much says there's not a super reliable sign that you can look for to pick this up clinically. His answer to my question was, I thought he said water brash pulse. I wrote it down twice. Water brash, that's what it sounded like. Looking around, I can't find anything called that. So I don't know if that's maybe a term that was just used locally where he was trained, or if I just didn't hear him correctly. he described this as the patient's entire upper body like rocking back and forth with the pulse. And the way he demonstrated it was very pronounced. Like he looked like he was sitting in a rocking chair up there. So I don't know if he was just doing that in an exaggerated way so I could see it or whatever. The only similar thing I can find in searching around is called a water hammer pulse, aka collapsing pulse or Corrigan's pulse, named after, I assume, Dr. Corrigan, who discovered it. And this is a thing that you feel with your fingers, like palpating a radial pulse. It's a very bounding, forceful pulse with a rapid upstroke and descent, most commonly associated with aortic regurgitation. You can also see this. Dr. Corrigan first described it by seeing it in the carotid arteries. He noticed they suddenly became distended and then quickly collapsed. And then another guy, Dr. Watson, investigated the palpable version of this later, and he thought it felt similar to something he felt when he was playing with a water hammer toy, which was some kind of deal that, which sounds like it was a vacuum tube that was half full of water. And if you turned it over, the sound of the water hitting the wall sounded like a hammer. That's not what I was thinking. I've heard of water hammering where, like, you know, you turn off the faucet quickly and you hear that kind of banging sound where the water suddenly stops flowing. I thought that's what it meant. I didn't know there was an actual toy called a water hammer. I see you can actually still buy these things. I will put a link to a video that demonstrates this in the show notes. How about that? Most of what Dr. Gallegos covered in his talk was the different types of thoracic aneurysms and the different zones that they are known by. And then he sort of touched on the surgical procedures for repairing them, which I really don't need to know since I'm not planning on doing any aortic surgery on anybody. But it was a good talk. I enjoyed his point of view on things. The third talk was about anticoagulation and antiplatelet management in acute coronary syndrome. This was given by Monroe Crawley, who is a PharmD pharmacist at Huntsville Hospital. He's obviously really smart and talked really fast. He covered a lot of ground. One thing that I pulled out of his talk that was interesting that I'd kind of forgotten was the mechanism of action of the COX inhibitor medications. So these are the NSAIDs and aspirin. There are some differences in the way aspirin and the different NSAIDs work on COX-1 versus COX-2. Aspirin irreversibly inhibits both of them. And what that does is help stop the conversion of arachidonic acid into prostaglandin. The COX stands for cyclooxygenase, which is an enzyme that catalyzes that conversion. And of course, the reason we would want to give that in acute coronary syndrome would be to inhibit platelet aggregation and hopefully stop the clot forming in the coronary artery from getting any bigger. And of course, the reason we want this for our other NSAIDs is to help decrease the effect of prostaglandin on inflammation. He also talked about anticoagulation given right before PCI, which can be done with heparin, low molecular weight heparin, or bivalirudin. There are two reasons to do this. The first is to try to stop the thrombin generation that has been caused by the rupture of the plaque itself. But the other reason is to stop more thrombin from being generated by the physician sticking things into the arteries, right? Both the stents and the devices they use for angioplasty. All that causes thrombin and the clotting cascade to happen as well. So those are the two reasons for giving anticoagulation prior to these procedures, which I really wouldn't have thought about the iatrogenic component there. The studies of using heparin versus the bivalirudin are kind of ongoing. I think he was saying there are several in progress, and you can find several that have already been done if you look around. And really, he said there's no clear answer yet, so no strong preference for one or the other there. Then he went into the differences in the P2Y12 inhibitors versus the glycoprotein 2B3A inhibitors. Those are both antiplatelet agents that would be used during and after stent placement. The glycoprotein 2B3A inhibitors are tirofiban and eptifibatide. Neither of these are medications that I am familiar with. I think they would only be given inpatient right before these PCI procedures. The common brand name of the tirofiban is Aggrastat, and the common brand name of the eptifibatide is Integrilin. Versus the P2Y12 inhibitors, which are the ones we're more familiar with in outpatient land, including the clopidogrel or Plavix, ticagrelor, which is Brilinta, prasugrel, which is Effient. There's one called ticlotapine, which sounds like it would be a calcium channel blocker, which goes under the brand name Ticlid, T-I-C-L-I-D. And then there's another one of these that's an IV form, which is Cangrelor. This is one I definitely had not heard of before. The brand name is Kengrial. Kengrial. He talked a lot about that one. And the main advantage there is that you only have to stop it about 20 minutes prior to any kind of procedure. All these other ones, if people are on it, it's going to take hours or days for those to get out of the system if they have to be stopped for some kind of procedure. But this one, if you're using it, you basically just turn it off and 20 minutes later, it's gone. So I could see why that would be a big benefit of using it inpatient. He was saying that it's very expensive, so I assume that means it doesn't get used very often or no more often than they have to. But yeah, I didn't know that existed. Of course, he was talking about the dual antiplatelet therapy after PCI, after stent insertion. Still, the plan there is to continue aspirin pretty much forever for people who have stents, and then the second antiplatelet agent for at least a year after the stent's placed. Somebody in the audience asked a question about antiplatelet properties of colchicine. There's been some research into potential cardiovascular benefits of colchicine that I've seen pop up here and there. I hadn't seen anything about antiplatelet properties of it, and the pharmacist that was giving the talk had not seen anything about that either. But sure enough, I found a study where they did find some potential antiplatelet effect of colchicine on patients who were already on dual antiplatelet therapy with aspirin and clopidogrel. That was a study from 2020. So that's really interesting. Maybe we'll see some more cardiovascular uses for colchicine come along down the line. And another thing that he mentioned that I wasn't really familiar with was anti-10A monitoring instead of the PTT for monitoring heparin therapy. It may be that monitoring anti-10A or anti-factor 10A is actually more beneficial than the PTT. Apparently, there have been some studies that show that using that leads to fewer dose adjustments, fewer lab tests, but other studies have not shown that. So that's really interesting. I've always thought of that as gospel. You know, PTT is what you use to monitor heparin. I ask the nursing students that all the time. Somebody told me one time to think of the two T's as an H. You know, the two T's together kind of look like an H. And that's how you remember PTT is what you use to monitor heparin. But maybe in the future, we'll be monitoring anti-10A instead of the PTT. The last session was probably my favorite. It was a talk about cardiotoxic effects of chemotherapy from Dr. Carrie Linneman, who is a cardio-oncologist at UAB. The first thing I wrote down in my notes was, cardio-oncology is a thing. She is a cardiologist, but UAB actually has a cardio-oncology clinic where she sees patients who are being treated with different forms of chemotherapy, and her job is to monitor or adjust for the effects of those medications on the heart. Very, very cool. She referred to a set of guidelines that came out in 2022 from the ESC, which is the European Society of Cardiology, that specifically address the different heart effects of different types of chemotherapy drugs. So, of course, I'll put a link to those in the show notes. It's a dense document. It's not a quick thing to look at. There's a lot of information in there. But you can use the information in those guidelines to figure out who should be monitored and at what intervals after, during, and after receiving the different chemotherapy drugs. And this is not something that I really have paid attention to much at all. You know, pretty much we turn people over to the oncologist for their cancer treatment and we just sort of follow along. I don't know that I even really pay that much attention to what specific medicines people have gotten. We pretty much just rely on oncology for that. She specifically talked about the anthracycline class of medication. Apparently, those are the worst offenders for causing heart issues after treatment, during and after treatment. The cumulative amount of exposure that somebody gets to those medications matters a lot as far as how much it affects the heart. There's a cardiotoxicity risk assessment tool that a person can use to figure out or to help give you an idea of somebody's specific risk. There's a link to that in the show notes. It's called the HFA-ICOS Cardio-Oncology Risk Assessment. That's available at cancercalc.com. She mentioned that several common medications might actually be protective for the heart, including ACEs and ARBs. And she said maybe the ARNI medication as well, the angiotensin receptor / neprilysin inhibitor, which is the sacubitril-valsartan combination, also known as Entresto, that we're seeing show up a lot in our heart failure patients. Could be that beta blockers, statins, and SGLT2s may also have some cardioprotective effects. There's a lot of research ongoing in that, she was saying. One thing that they do monitor during people's treatment is the troponin level. You can actually use that to gauge how sensitive a person's heart cells are to the particular chemo drugs that they're receiving. She mentioned that those anthracyclines are colloquially referred to as red devils. I guess they all have red labels, so that's where that came from. They're very commonly used in treatment of lymphoma and leukemia, as well as some types of sarcoma and breast cancer. Another specific class of medicine she mentioned are the Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitors, or BTK inhibitors. She was talking about the larger class of tyrosine kinase inhibitor is like vast, and there are all kinds of different subtypes and overlapping types of medicines and stuff, but apparently it's these Bruton's ones that are more brutal for the heart. I just made that up. She didn't say that. These things are used for some leukemias and lymphomas. There's one in particular called ibrutinib, also known as Imbruvica. That one very commonly causes atrial fibrillation. She was saying that when her fellows and residents come to her talking about a patient with new onset atrial fib, her first question is always whether or not they receive this medication for their cancer treatment. It's even more fun because not only does it cause atrial fib, but it interacts with a lot of the anticoagulants and antiarrhythmic medications that a person with atrial fib would need to take. So it makes the management of the atrial fib that it caused especially difficult. The ACC has a specific chart just for this that you can look at to think about risk assessment and monitoring. There's a link to that in the show notes. She also mentioned a tool called the SPARC, S-P-A-R-C. I think I've heard of this before. It just combines the CHADS-VASc and the HasBLED score. You know, the CHADS-VASc is what they use to figure out who needs to be on anticoagulation among people who have atrial fib. And the HasBLED is kind of the other side of that, where they figure out who's at most risk for having inappropriate bleeding on the anticoagulation. So the SPARC tool combines those, so you can look at them both at the same time. She said she uses that a lot in assessing her patients. Then she pivoted and talked about the immune checkpoint inhibitors. These are kind of like the latest and greatest, right? We're seeing a lot of patients being treated with immunotherapy instead of chemotherapy. These are the medicines that use the body's own T cells to attack the cancer cells, so they don't have a lot of risk as far as the traditional side effects and adverse effects that we think of with the older chemotherapy medications. The thing is, with these kind of medicines, you do get complications when the T cells get a little bit overaggressive and start having some action on normal tissue, not just cancer tissues. So essentially, it creates an autoimmune disease. Cardiovascular complications that you can see with this include dysrhythmias, myocarditis, vasculitis, Takotsubo-like cardiomyopathy, or pericardial disease. There's a trial called Atrium that's ongoing that I believe she is actually participating in, that I think she said is enrolling patients. So I'll put a link to that if you happen to have any patients that might qualify for that. Some different resources that she pointed out that I'll put links to include, of course, the ACC, CardioSmart, which is a site for both patients and clinicians. That's an offshoot of ACC. It's just a good resource for all things cardiac, whether for yourself or for your patients. Looks like it would be a really good thing to direct patients to get legitimate information from about their heart issues. ICOS is a program at UAB, which stands for Institute for Cancer Outcomes and Survivorship, which looks like a good resource for people who are survivors of cancer. Dr. Linneman also mentioned a regular Zoom call that happens among the clinicians at UAB that sounds like sort of like a tumor board situation where they just discuss cases and research and such. She made it sound like you could sign up to be on that call, participate in it, and maybe in the future get some CEUs for it. It sounded like they were probably working on that. I can't find anything about that specifically on the UAB website, but they do have a schedule of some other classes and things that you can sign up for that are available. And actually, when you go to the cardio-oncology program, there's a video right on the first page there that is by Dr. Linneman that gave this talk also. She seemed like a pretty normal person. It was enjoyable listening to her. It seems like she'd be very good at treating the population she's dealing with. And it was definitely a privilege to have her attend the conference in Huntsville. All right, so that's pretty much what I picked up on. I'm just reading through my little hand-scrawled notes that I made. I haven't taken notes like that since I was a student in college, probably. It turns out I still do remember how to write in cursive. It took me a minute to decipher some of this, but I think that is still a skill that I possess. If you have any questions, suggestions, corrections, anything, of course, reach out. You can contact me by email, thekppod@gmail.com, through the website, thekppod.com, or through the new Facebook page, which I encourage you to check out. You can find that by searching for Knowledgeable Provider on Facebook. All right, that does it for this episode of Knowledgeable Provider. I'm your host, Jody Marks. Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to like, subscribe, or follow on your preferred listening platform. Give us a nice 5-star rating and leave a nice review. If you'd like to help support the show, you can do that at patreon.com/knowledgeableprovider. And as always, stay safe, take care of yourself, and take care of your patients in that order. The people